This is the podcast of AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. AK is a weekly show that presents the stories and sounds of Alaska's characters, cultures, and current events. AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmute.
From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast, from the Kuskokwim Delta to the Upper Yukon River, from the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior, this is AK. This week on AK, a look back at the best of summer. We'll visit with a super pot of whales and meet some of the people who make their living off Alaska's summer festivals. And how a series of volcanoes kept things hopping in the Aleutians.
When it got dark like that and the ash was falling, you knew that there was no way that the Coast Guard could bring a helicopter in there, or anybody could bring a helicopter in there.
Plus, erecting a Tlingit totem in honor of a Japanese photographer. That and more coming up on AK from APRN. Welcome to AK. I'm Scott Burton. For most of the summer, AK aired reruns, so we didn't get a chance to bring you some of the best stories of the summer. Now, some of you will think, Ted Stevens indicted, that was major, or, wait, Sarah Palin, of course, that's the biggest story of the summer. Those are also ongoing stories, covered in the news every day, so you won't find them on AK, not this week anyway. Instead, we're playing catch-up on neat, quirky Alaskan stories. In the Aleutians, the summer was cold and foggy, not unlike many other parts of the state. But it was also explosive. Three different volcanoes erupted within 4 weeks, causing evacuations, canceled flights, and the remaking of an island. In Unalaska, Ann Hillman experienced them all.
The Aleutians started rumbling on July 12th when Okmok Volcano on Umnak Island unexpectedly sent a plume of ash 50,000 feet into the air. The small Fort Glen cattle ranch sat near the base of the volcano. Ranch manager Lonnie Kennedy used his tiny helicopter to move 7 of the 10 ranch residents across the strait to a remote part of Unalaska Island. The ash in the air was too thick to make another trip for the remaining 2.
And I turned around and looked, and it was just, by then it was black. I couldn't even see Umnak anymore. And I called him on the VHF, and I said, I can't do it. It just made me sick not to be able to, but I knew there was no way I even could have flown over there probably without crashing. So,
they sent out a call for help to all nearby marine vessels. The fishing vessel, Terry Gale, responded.
Oh, yeah, of course I was nervous, running straight into that thing. But, like I said, if it was me sitting there, I'd sure hope somebody would come and get me. and when it got dark like that and the ash was falling, you knew that there was no way that the Coast Guard could bring a helicopter in there, or anybody could bring a helicopter in there.
Dwayne Freeman is the Terry Gale's captain. He says they first went to Umnak Island and picked up the 2 men stranded there.
It was 1 in the afternoon, and I've not seen even nighttime be that dark because it was black, like sand raining out of the sky.
The ash was so thick, Freeman couldn't see the 2 men standing on a small dock until they shot a gun into the air to get his attention. The ship then went to pick up the others across the strait. Using the ship's life raft, they transported everyone, including a small infant, onto the fishing boat and headed towards the city of Unalaska.
Looking at the Unalaska Island, it was all black. No green, no vegetation. It was covered black. The hills were black.
They arrived safely into Unalaska, where they stayed a few weeks, before returning to the ranch to check on the cattle and assess the damages. In the meantime, on July 21st, Mount Cleveland on Chuganenadak Island began its eruption.
It's erupting big time. When we went by Akamon, it's a big old mushroom.
That was the fishing vessel Pearl J speaking to the Coast Guard over the radio. They were in the pass next to Mount Cleveland, about 10 miles west of the processing vessel, the Lady Goodney. The Pearl J was about to put out its fishing gear. The Lady Goodney was going to offload passengers onto the island. Plans changed. Within an hour, the Lady Goodney was covered in fine black ash from the 6-mile-wide ash cloud. After waiting out the night, passengers decided to go ashore, despite the light coating of ash over the island and the low rumbles of the volcano in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
They camped about 6 miles from the volcano for 5 days before heading back to Unalaska when, again, plans changed. Ash from Okmok and Cleveland had prevented planes from reaching the village of Nikolsky for almost 3 weeks. Villagers and visitors were stranded. The Lady Goodney's captain, Christian Laxfoss, decided to pick up the 10 passengers.
Yeah, there was no way I could not do it. And I was there, so hey, the more the merrier. We have one-third of the whole city on the boat.
One of the evacuees was the 8-month pregnant health aide. It took over a month for planes to return to Nikolsky with food, supplies, and medicines, because soon after Cleveland erupted, Kasatochi exploded on August 7th. After 2 days of intensive seismic activity, two U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologists were evacuated from the island shortly before three explosive eruptions. The first two sent giant plumes of gas into the air. The third covered the island in a layer of boulders and volcanic debris, sheathed in what Alaska Volcano Observatory scientist Chris Way Thomas calls pyroclastic flow.
Like mud, right? Yeah. That's what's all over the surface. It's very soft and sticky, very fine grained. If it's in some places, it's wet and like quicksand almost.
The eruption turned a lush green island into a giant gray mass. Fish and Wildlife biologist Jeff Williams says the island used to be home to 100,000 nesting auklets, thousands of puffins and storm petrels, and hundreds of gulls. He says many of them may have survived.
That's the nice thing about being in a bird on a volcanic island. If it does erupt, you can just fly away. But if you're a chick inside a burrow or a crevice or on a nest, you're not going to get away. So those ones probably perished, I would think.
Some of the sea lions who used to breed there have already started to return, but botanists say it could take 20 to 50 years for plants to repopulate the island. Ash and gas from Kasatochi created a giant cloud that traveled across Alaska and caused the cancellation of over 50 flights. The cloud crossed North America and was seen over Spain. In the weeks since Kasatochi's eruption, activity on all three volcanoes has declined, and the Aleutians seem quiet again. Scientists say the eruptions are not linked, and the timing was just coincidental. For AK, I'm Ann Hillman in Unalaska.
Researchers have been studying whales off the coast of Alaska since the 1970s. This summer, their research focused mainly on killer whales in the northwestern portion of the Gulf of Alaska. On a Monday in August, a tour boat in Kachemak Bay called in a sighting of whales. But what researchers found wasn't just a pod, it was a superpod. Emily Schwing has more.
The research vessel Natoa bobs around lightly in the unusually calm waters of Kachemak Bay, where scientists from the North Gulf Oceanic Society have been searching for whales all summer. NGOS uses the Natoa to conduct long-term research on the life history of whales. And on this day, biologists on the boat have all but struck gold.
This is a whale extravaganza. God, not to make your head spin.
That's Craig Matkin. He assures me I will never see a sight like this again. It's a superpod of whales. We see rows of dorsal fins emerging from the water.
Unreal. They're all lined up. What a bonanza.
Matkin refers to this as picket fencing, and that's exactly what it looks like. There are over 100 whales in all directions. A few are on their backs, and one is slapping its fluke. They're all nearly swimming on top of each other. Matkin is the founding director of NGOS, and he's been photographing the dorsal fin and unique saddle patch of killer whales in Alaska since 1977. Today's photos and those from years past help the researchers keep track of Alaska's killer whales. Matkin says today makes for easy work.
When the whales are like this resting, it's great because the maternal groups, the related animals, all get together and they swim next to their relatives. So you do a lot of the ID work by association. You figure out one animal, and then you see these other animals around it. When they're lined up like this, it's perfect for identification of individuals. Makes it a lot easier when you look at the pictures later on.
Okay. Each whale is given a code name and their pictures will be cataloged. Matkin says there are whales he's photographed that he's seen again and again for the past 30 years.
These whales look like they're mainly whales that hang out more down toward Kodiak. They're not the ones I usually see up in Prince William Sound and Kenai Fjords. So it'll take a little sorting to figure these out. But this is great because it takes me a long time to see these whales up in Kenai Fjords because they don't come up there very often. So now that I'm down more in their, probably what is this, more the center of their home range, I can get the pictures of my need for this year to keep track of who's born and who's died in the group. Interesting thing is they've come all the way in here to catch Mac Bay because I don't think they come in here all that often.
These are resident killer whales. They eat only fish. Transient killer whales also live in Alaskan waters, but they feed on marine mammals. Matkin and his colleague L.A. Holmes say it's easy to tell the difference just by looking at their dorsal fins.
The shape of the fin and the saddle patch, you notice how some of the saddle patches have a dark indentation in them that we call a open saddle, and that's only in residence. Saddle patch is smaller generally in residence. The fins aren't as pointy. They're more falcate with the residents.
And transients don't come in groups of 100.
Yeah.
Transients usually come in groups of 2 to 10.
Even resident killer whales only come together in groups this large once a year to meet and greet each other before the mating season.
Yeah, they're really social animals, and when they rest, it's when they get all their socializing out, I guess. It's really important for them to touch in with their close relatives pretty frequently.
They're probably listening to this other group approaching from Pogie Point. They can hear that kind of distance, and they may be excited if it's a new group they haven't seen in a while. And when they get together with another group that they haven't seen in a while, they can put on quite a display, and a lot of socializing going on and kind of re-meeting friends.
That's Cy St. Amand. He's also taking pictures of the whales. After Matkin and St. Amand are finished photographing the animals, Matkin uses a small charge and a buoyant dart to retrieve skin and blubber samples from two free-swimming adult males. The whales don't even notice as they swim past the boat. Once he returns to land, Matkin will analyze the skin samples for DNA and information about what the whales are eating. The blubber will be sampled for potential contaminants. There's no real long-term data on killer whales in Alaska, and the information collected today is invaluable to the North Gulf Oceanic Society. Reporting from the Natoa, I'm Emily Schwing.
Coming up after the break, making music in the backcountry and spending all that money the state just gave us.
I think it's pretty exciting for everybody to be getting some money and be able to, you know, pay for their gas and pay for their fuel to heat their houses this winter.
I guess it'll just go into the general pot and try and pay $5 oil, part of it.
Stay with us. Welcome back to AK. This week we're hitting some of the highlights of summer. But for some people, the highlight may have just come at the end. On Friday, the state started distributing almost $3,300 to each Alaskan who qualified for the Permanent Fund Dividend. The amount includes a one-time-only $1,200 resource rebate designed to help Alaskans cope with the high energy costs. And it looks like many people are using it that way.
My college student, when I called her this week telling her what the amount was going to be, she is thrilled.
I think it's fine. I'm going to use mine to pay off some credit cards and make a big donation to Planned Parenthood in honor of Sarah Palin.
We're going to take care of the fuel costs, and we're going to put the rest in the bank for whatever expenses come up in the year.
I think it's a good thing for the state to distribute the wealth to the people. The legislators can find places to spend it, and the people can do just as good a job at deciding how they spend their money as the legislators. So I think distributing that money to the people, keeping them involved and interested in what happens to the permanent fund, et cetera, is a good thing.
I think it's reasonable, and I think I believe that because the oil, basically, the $1,200 is basically because the state had a windfall of oil revenue. And who better but the citizens to receive it?
It's hard to tell what the effect of the bigger payment will be. Some are predicting that more families will leave rural areas and move to urban areas. But on this week's segment of 300 Villages, we found at least one small community that is growing, Edna Bay near Prince of Wales Island. We'll also check in with Barrow.
My name is Heather Richter. I live in Edna Bay, Alaska, and I'm president of the Edna Bay community. Edna Bay is located approximately 70 miles from Ketchikan on Kosciuszko Island. Well, we used to be a fishing community, and now we're much more diverse. We have families who do logging and fishing both. Some of the families actually go out of the bay to work. We have about 50 residents currently. The population's definitely growing. The Southeast Island School District just reopened the school here in Edna Bay, and there's several people who are in the process of moving here that have children who weren't able to move here previously because the requirements of homeschooling and working at the same time were more than they wanted to take on, so it's allowing more people to move here. There's a big issue right now going on, the H.R. 3560 bill in Congress right now, where Sea Alaska is trying to acquire lands that are next to our community. We've been actively fighting against that. Currently, we use all of those areas that Sea Alaska would be obtaining to hunt and fish and gather berries and medicinal herbs and mushrooms. We're not against logging completely, but in that scope would be quite devastating to our communities.
I'm Thomas Olimau. I'm the executive director, president of the Native Village of Barrow Tribal Council. The population for the community of Barrow, Alaska is about 4,300. We have the Eskimo name Ukbearvik, which means on snowy owl, so they call it Ukbearvik, where back then there will be a lot of snowy owls up here. Right now we have a football program that has recently been started up here in the community of Barrow. 3 years ago, I think this is the third year, but majority of them are basketball, recreation, We have short summers up here, so during when school starts in winter comes around, basketball is the main sport up here on the North Slope. There's a lot of subsistence, we do our bowhead whaling in April, May, June through October. A lot of people harvest caribou, fish, and pick berries up inland and go to their campsites and stay there for about 10 days or about a week to harvest their animals because to load up their isolates for the winter because we have short summer months up here in the community of Barrow. Fall time, late September, October, there's a fall whaling. So we get ready for that too. Yeah, the PFD is good timing because September, when we have some hunters go boating and that's the money they could use to purchase gas to go hunting and harvest caribou and fish.
We heard from Heather Richter in Edna Bay and Thomas Ulamoun in Barrow. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. The summer festival scene is just about over for the year, but back in August it was in full swing. That's when I boarded a small plane at the entrance to Denali National Park. In the air, we could see the twisting, turning park highway below. The tundra was just beginning to change colors, and we passed several groups of doll sheep high on the mountainsides before landing at the remote community of Kantishna. Once a mining camp, Kantishna is now a tourist destination and home to some 120 seasonal workers and 5 lodges. The spot is abundant in beauty and recreation, but lacking in things like live music. So in 1996, a group of the camp's residents decided to bring music to them and began the Kantishna Music Festival. Now, some people might think living at the end of a gravel road over 4 hours into Denali National Park would be a piece of summer heaven.
Part of the best thing is being remote, and part of the most challenging thing is being that remote.
Anne Bellarier lives in Kantishna, the area known as the west end of the park during the tourist season.
Being out in the middle of the park and having wilderness right at your backyard. So days off are spent primarily hiking and getting out and enjoying a part of the park that not that many people get all the way out to.
In the winter, Bellarier lives near the park entrance on the park's highway. It's known as the East End and includes Healy, Cantwell, Denali Park, and McKinley Village. Many of the people who spend summers in Kantishna or work in other parts of the park live there in winter, and it's a close-knit community. But with little time off during the intense tourist season and the four-hour-plus drive, these close friends from each end don't get to hang out much.
By the end of the summer, I really miss people, family and friends that I don't really get the opportunity to see all summer long. Since you've been gone.
Skyline Lodge and Kantishna Air Taxi owner Greg LaHaye says the need for a locally minded summertime social event and Kantishna's lack of live music is why he and a few friends started the festival.
Started off with just a little festival up at the Kantishna Roadhouse. Roberta Wilson used to invite some guitar playing folks out, and then that lodge changed hands, and so we kind of kept the tradition going and just have been building down at the airstrip. We threw it in the barn one time on the road, and eventually we got this land in 2000. So now we have a wonderful place and a good venue to do some indoor acts, and then the late night goes outside on the road, and we all dance around and watch the moon and the northern lights.
The first year included about 50 folks. This year, close to 175 people are stomping around under the stars, the full moon, and the northern lights on a road that's more used to bus traffic. Mike Speaks has attended the festival since it began and is proud of the people and the music the festival draws.
Tim has been associated with the festival, Tim Easton. He's a very well-known Lower 48 musician who loves it out there. And then our own Alaska representatives. We've got some of the best musicians anywhere, and when they're all out there, Saturday night's campfire is so fun, and then Sunday's all-day performance, you know, with a nighttime dance in the street. It's all so fun. It didn't really compare to any other kind of event.
The isolation and beauty that contribute to the festival's uniqueness can also cause challenges. Co-founder Jimmy Sandy remembers one time when the sound equipment almost didn't make it.
Really cold, windy, rainy day, which has happened more than not in the past. And I'm like, so where's the stage? And they go, it's over the old airship. We got to drive across the river. And I'm like, what do you mean drive across the river? My truck's full of my thousands of dollars worth of equipment. They go, oh, no, you can make it. There's a spot where... And when I saw it, I'm like, I don't know. So I drove across, and they said, make sure you stay right behind him, otherwise you will get washed down the river. I'm like, oh, no.
Thank you.
So, yep, we made it. It came up against my door, but...
Sandy likes the moderate rate at which the festival's grown and says it's probably due to its remoteness. The festival is free, except for getting there. That usually takes a flight or a $50 bus ticket. Only a few performers obtain the highly coveted permits to drive the road.
Anybody can come to this. If you can get out here and you can, you know, be self-contained, it's very important that you have your tent, your food, and everything. Mm-hmm. And if you can get out here and you're respectable to the land and everything and keep your food in bear boxes, then come on out. You know, it's always a fun time.
Organizers deliberately keep the festival to one day, to keep the number small and the festival sustainable. They hope the biggest impact of having all these extra people in the park is that a few of the locals might have a tough time making it to work the next day.
Same old mill grinds day and night. Same old mill.
Kantishna's Music Festival doesn't feature vendors selling crafts, but plenty of Alaska summer festivals do, whether they're one-time events or ongoing, like Anchorage's popular downtown weekend market. The white market tents were furled for the season last week, and craft and food vendors who spent the summer there began packing up for the winter. AK's Ellen Lockyer, who did double duty as stage manager for the market this year, spoke with some of the craftspeople about what the coming months may have in store for them.
The Digamiok Bight Native dancers held the stage for the last time this summer. The teen dancers will be returning to their usual high school routine, but for adult vendors, the next 8 months or so will be a challenge of sorts. Arlene Hayward makes small ceramic whistles called ocarinas. She splits her time between Hawaii and Alaska.
So the last 12 years, I go back and forth?
Yeah, I have one of your ocarinas, and I never got past Valerie.
Okay, that's first page, so you got about 7 or 8 more pages you can run through.
The Christmas songs.
Yeah. So, yeah, for the last 3 years, I have stopped my Christmas seasons, but prior to that, you know, since 92, I've pretty much been doing year-round sales and producing all the time, and now I'm going to take a little break for, you know, this Christmas season. Probably next season you'll see me back, but summer, for sure.
Normally, would you just move on to warmer climate?
I don't, because I live in one of the poorest communities in the world, actually, or in the country. So, it's in Hawaii, in Puna, on the Big Island. So, because of that, I just know to focus on producing, and then I go off-island for sales. This has pretty much taken up all my time in production.
Across the aisle, a lady known as Dom sells wooden croaking frogs.
Where are these made?
In Thailand.
Thailand. Oh, they're so cute.
This is the last day of the fair. Do you go to other fairs during the winter? You just stay home?
Yeah.
Thank you, Dom.
While Dom stays home, many of the Alaska-based vendors do travel for work or just for fun.
Kent Schumacher.
And you are a
Pictures Plus, seller of Alaskan artwork and other artwork, and Cussbucks. Yes, ma'am.
Baby Cussbucks. So what do you do in the winter?
I do other bazaars. I do winter bazaars.
Where do you go?
I go from Anchorage to Seward to Kenai to Wasilla. I stay here, right interstate.
Who makes those cute little...
My mom makes the cussbucks.
I get to do Make Alaska in 3 weeks, so I'm going to get busy.
We get 2 weeks off, yep.
Les Bertner, Salmon Express.
You are the quesadilla man. Now, what have you been doing all summer?
Cooking quesadillas here at the Saturday market, mostly.
Well, today's last day. What are you going to do after this?
Well, we're going to travel. We're going to travel locally. We're going to McCarthy and Kennecott. Then we're going out to the Midwest with family reunion.
Do you work fairs in the wintertime?
Nope, not anymore. I'm partially retired. I do the Saturday, Sunday market and the Alaska State Fair. That's all I do. We have a good following here now. I've been here 12 years, so keep turning out the same good product, good Alaska salmon. And after the Midwest trip, we're going around the world on a boat, 10 countries. So it's a year of travel, back in May.
I'm Susan Grace Blandit.
I am Susie the Bead Lady.
We're on our 15th year. It's a small, well-organized market. It becomes kind of a community. You know the people around you.
Yeah. So what's next?
We do travel in the winter. We will be doing a couple of shows, the Alaska Bead and Jewelry Show in October. And then we pop up to Fairbanks for a show up in Fairbanks, the Christmas show. We drive to Haines, get on the ferry, go to Juneau for the Thanksgiving show in Juneau, and then back on the ferry down to Bellingham, Washington, drive to California. Wow. Did I mention we have a month in Bali?
Yeah.
December in Bali? Oh, did I forget that?
Is this a stable way to make a living, or is it?
You know, it's. I think you have to be a traveler. We love traveling. Our shows are dependent on location, and so we did 7 international gym shows last year in California, Oregon, Washington.
Of course, all that traveling has to be paid for by long hours all summer in Alaska. I asked wood carver Walter Bennett what's the hardest part.
besides getting up at 3:30 in the morning on Saturday. That's about the only tough part of it. I mean, I enjoy it. Yeah, we meet a lot of nice people. 99.9% of the people are wonderful, and the other 0.01% we can ignore.
For Suzanne the Bead Lady, Walter Bennett, and others, life as a vagabond vendor is good any season. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
After the break,
introducing more seaweed into the diet and more local fungus.
Going local at the farmer's market. Stay with us. You're listening to AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Scott Burton, and this week, we're savoring the best of the summer, like fresh local food. With more interest in eating locally, new farmers markets have been sprouting up in Alaska. Many Sitkins have long known the value of eating local seafood or wild edible plants, but this was the first year they held a farmers market to help more people taste the benefits. Bonnie Sue Hitchcock visited with organizers before the first event.
On average, Americans usually live about 1,300 miles from where their food is produced. Linda Williams, one of the organizers for the farmers market, says for Sitkins, that distance is probably even greater.
I imagine it's a couple hundred miles more for us. When you have that long distance to travel, that's going to take some time. You get 7 to 14 days in transit, you're going to lose some of the nutritional value and the flavor.
Plus, Williams says, if we eat food that has to be flown or barged in, that increases our carbon footprint and limits the variety of food we get.
You know, most of the fruit and vegetable varieties sold today are based on their ability to travel and the ability also for them to be harvested in an industrial manner. But there are many, many varieties of vegetables and fruits out there that we never even see in our grocery stores.
And that's where the farmers market comes in.
I think it's a fabulous idea.
That's Sitka gardener Lori Adams.
Produce costs a lot up here, and it's kind of the same idea as like the Victory Garden. You know, everybody could be a little bit more independent, and we could all grow a little something.
Adams has been gardening in Sitka for more than 15 years. She says she still struggles with things like getting the right nutrients for her root vegetables.
I don't grow enough volume to feed us. So it's more, right now, it's more like a hobby. So if when the strawberries are ripe, I make enough jam to feed us for the whole year. I could put up enough rhubarb, enough raspberries. But to grow enough peas for a whole year, that's like impossible.
Organizer Carrie McLean says these things do take time to build. In 1993, he was the only booth at a farmer's market in Port Gamble, Washington. Today, that same market is sprawling with vendors. McLean says it's about drawing the community together using local resources as a starting point. And he says that means Sitka hopes to be more than just a farmer's market, but a fisherman's market as well.
There's actually a whole bunch of people that don't have ready access to fish. I've gone to the co-op, and it's all gone down south, you know? So hopefully this will just be another outlet, you know, diversification of marketing.
In order to sell at the farmer's market, fishermen must have a processor's license, meaning anyone who can sell off their boat can sell at the market. Julia Schlutius of Sienna Seafood says that's not a problem for her family's frozen-at-sea processor. But she says getting a processor's license just for the market would be a lot of paperwork. Plus, the price of frozen-at-sea salmon is so high, she says she feels guilty charging her friends and neighbors what the fish is worth.
We're getting about $4 a pound for frozen-at-sea cohos. And if we fillet that fish, you know, that would take so much of the product away, and then having it vacuum packed on top of that, it would make a pound of coho about $7 or $6.50, which is probably offensive for people. They would not want to pay that price.
Schlutia says she loves the idea of a fisherman's farmer's market and is trying to figure out the best economical way to be a part of it.
I could just sell the whole fish, you know, take orders, and then they can take it wherever they can take it to have it vacuum packed themselves.
The Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association will have a cart available with fresh and frozen fish. But Carrie McLean adds there will be vendors with cooked seafood and a variety of other products as well.
A lot of people making jams and jellies, and we actually have some people saving seeds and growing plants for sale, including native plants and some native edible plants. And we're really interested in trying to increase the amount of wildcrafted food. So introducing more seaweed into the diet and more local fungus.
Juno is also in the beginning stages of their first farmers market. And while it's a small response to rising food and energy prices, McLean says communities need to start thinking down the road to sustainability. He points to greenhouses at Chena Hot Springs near Fairbanks, which use geothermal energy and grow vegetables year-round. Sitka's challenge for large-volume produce is dirt. But he says we also have access to high-level composting capabilities. Sitka Tribe composted fish waste about 10 years ago, and McLean says there's interest in doing something similar again. A possible site could be the old water filtering plant at Sawmill Cove Industrial Park.
That would be absolutely perfect for municipal compost production. And there just happens to be two of them side by side. And they are lacking a roof, but you know what would make a really good roof might be an inflatable greenhouse. So you could produce compost on one side and food in the other.
Long-term plans notwithstanding, the early hope for the community's first farmers market is to have fun and to start educating people about what Sitka can do. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Organizers say this year's markets were successful, with more people attending each week and vendor space selling out. Next year, they plan to expand. Instead of holding the market on just three Saturdays, it will run for 3 months, June through August. The rhythmic precision and mind-blowing synchronization of Japanese ensemble drumming has long fascinated American audiences. In Anchorage, Sand Lake Elementary School's Japanese immersion program has its own drum group, Tomodachi Taiko. It was for students only up until a few years ago, when the city's Parks and Recreation Department opened up classes to adult beginners. Since then, the taiko craze has taken off in Alaska's biggest city. But as AK's Ellen Lockyer finds out, getting started in drum technique requires grit and determination.
They have become stars of YouTube and local supermarket promotions. You've probably seen them at folk festivals, too. Tomodachi Taiko, taiko means drum, have performed all over Alaska's biggest city, and drumstick-wielding third graders in Japanese garb are not an uncommon sight in some parts of Anchorage. But how do you get from here to there? It starts with a single downbeat, and it is not as easy as it may look. On the first night of adult taiko class at Sand Lake Elementary, 20 men and women line up in a row in front of teachers Sachiko and Toshi Kono. Neophyte drummers have to first learn to stand correctly and then bow.
So we do that at the same time. Okay?
In taiko drumming, self-discipline, respect for others, support, and fun are important, Sachiko says. Then there are strange words to learn.
Dojo. Taiko dojo.
One has to bow on entering the dojo, and on leaving, shout an enthusiastic ha!
And you bow, and you say, ha!
Then the drummers bring on the taiko. Each large drum is on a wheeled platform. Now they line them up in three rows, and a drummer stands at attention behind each taiko. There's drumsticks, called bachi, to buy, and special shoes,
tabi,
called tabi, to wear. They are white cloth with a rubber sole and a split between the big toe and the rest of the toes. Those who don't wear tabi must drum in bare feet. When the class absorbs all that, within the first half hour, the teachers get down to business.
Japanese-style stretch. Exercise.
Toshi Kono leads the class in spirited jumping jacks before any real drumming begins. It's invigorating, all right. Faces are flushed, and the drummers are already looking a bit wilted. And not one bachi has contacted a taiko drumhead yet. But the hardest part is still to come. First, Sachiko explains how the taiko are made.
This surface is made of what? Can you guess? Skin. What kind of skin? Cow. Your finger. This is a cow skin. And right here, this is a wine, old used wine barrel from California. When you open it, you can still smell.
Toshi demonstrates on the large Nagato taiko. Sachiko plays shimi taiko, small, high-pitched drums. Other rhythm instruments like small cymbals and bells are used to keep the beat. And Sachiko says a flute played along with the drums makes the piece more colorful. Ready yet? No. Next comes drummer's posture.
right leg diagonal back. And your toes kind of toward outside. And you bend your knees and your back straight.
The perfect drum posture is not exactly a natural alignment of back and limbs. It works better for shorter drummers than for those with long legs. After a few tries, though, everyone gets the hang of it. Now, we are ready to drum. Sachko gives the command, and the drummers stand at the drums, knees bent, bare feet grounded, and bocce lifted high above their heads.
You just let the bocce drop. And right before contact, you snap it, and you lift up immediately.
All 20 bocce come down on 20 drum heads. There's an explosion of sound, and the drummers are on their way. Mary Hasbrook started drumming 2 years ago and now is the interim president of the board of directors that addresses the business affairs of Tomodachi Taiko. Hasbrook says taiko is great exercise, for one thing.
Wonderful stress relief. Nothing like banging on a drum and screaming loud to get all the anxiety and tensions out.
She says there's no real sheet music to learn, and a musical background is not necessary.
It's a song, and if you learn to sing it, you should be able to learn to play it.
Hasbrook says it took a year to really get the hang of taiko drumming, but once it clicks in, there's no going back. There's more than 100 people in Tomodachi Taiko now, and the group just keeps growing. And you don't have to speak Japanese to join it. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Japanese photographer and writer Michio Hoshino had a unique way of walking through the world, until a bear took his life in Kamchatka 13 years ago. His images are well known around the globe, but many don't know the special way he interacted with nature and the ties he wove between Japanese people and Alaskans. Last month in Sitka, a totem pole was raised in his honor. Tlingit elders say it's the first time a pole has been raised to honor a non-native from overseas. Ann Kaiser has more.
We're going to do a memorial song. We're going to do Kots. That's the name we gave Michio. My brother lived a true story of how we felt about Alaska and our native culture.
Michio walked between two cultures, embracing not only the Taquari clan, who gave him a Tlingit name meaning bear, but also his Japanese family, who knew him as Oshino Michio, or a man walking in a field under the stars. His friend Tomiaki says, he became a man, just like his name.
When he was 16 years old, he wanted to go to America. And then so he asked his father to give him a permission to go there. And then, of course, his family said, no. And so you cannot go there. But Michio prepared many things, you know, he saved the money and then the documents. And then finally his father said, okay, you can go over there. And then he arrived to San Francisco, and then he decided, wow, this is a kind of the freedom he never feared. So he just followed the feeling of his freedom.
This feeling led him to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where at age 19 he began a lifetime free from the distractions of time. Once he was dropped off at Denali, and his friends expected him to be back in a week or two,
but he didn't come back for a long, long time. Maybe that a couple of months, I think, later. And then they decide to report the police. He's missing. Just right after they report he's missing, he got a phone call from Michio, from the Seward.
This is one of the characteristics about Michio that was so unique, says guide and close friend Lynn Schooler. When he had an image in his head he wanted to get on film, the amount of time it took wasn't important. It was more about getting the photo of exactly what he was trying to capture. It often took years.
What really surprised me is the number of times we went to a great deal of effort to get to a location, you know, climbing or, you know, getting through some deep brush or something like that and find a place and set up. And he'd take two or three, you know, exposures of the same thing and then he was done. Whereas a lot of photographers I've worked with are always pushing for one more image, one more image, one more you know, shot at something spectacular or amazing.
In retrospect, Schooler and Clinkett Bob Sam say for Michio, the images were more than just photographs. To him, they also represented the process of getting them. And the more time he spent out in nature, the more the world seemed to take care of him.
There's one story around that he flew up to the Arctic to spend a few weeks working on a caribou project that he'd been working on for 13, 14 years. And he actually forgot his tent. He flew into the Arctic without a tent. He got off the plane without a tent, you know. And none of the rest of us could have survived that. You know, we would have been eaten alive by mosquitoes, or, you know, it would have snowed, you know, 4 feet in August or whatever. You know, we just didn't have that kind of luck.
I have most of his books, and every photo that I see, it seems like nature poses for him. He was like a messenger from nature to teach us something about what's happening out there.
Sam says Michio hoped his photos would help people from Japan and Alaska reconnect to nature and to the land, something he felt was slipping away. Tomiaki says that's one of the reasons he started taking kids from Japan up to camp on the Ruth Glacier back in 1990.
When the kids in Japan, they go on the glacier, there's nothing to do. And then, but they know the silence and also the magnificent existence of nature.
Michio was planting seeds, hoping over time they would learn and grow from their experiences together. He also supported travel between the Clinkets and the ancient people of Japan.
In Hokkaido, there's a museum there, and they have a map, and it shows the ancient people trading from Hokkaido to Queen Charlotte Islands, that this trade has been going on for thousands of years.
The ancient people have long known about this relationship, but Sam says most Alaskan natives didn't, not until they met Michio. Some even believe their ancestors, which is one of the reasons friends from both continents chose to have a totem pole carved. It marks the time of their reconnection and offers a way of thanking Michio for all he's done.
The Tekwadi are shedding their tears for the last time today for Michio. From this point on, we're going to go into a happy time.
His friends say seeing the pole in place has made them think back to the day the bear took his life. But they've all forgiven him. As one friend added, it was a bad bear that just didn't know who Michio was. Reporting in Sitka for AK, I'm Ann Kaiser.
Before we leave today, we've got a request. We're looking for ethical dilemmas. On an upcoming show, we'd like to pose some real-life ethical issues to a few experts, and we'd like you to supply the questions. If you faced an ethical dilemma recently, tell us about it. Email ak@aprn.org and let us know how we can reach you to follow up. That's ak@aprn.org. And that's AK for this week. We had help from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Emily Schwing in Homer, and Ann Kaiser and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka. Also thanks to Lynn Mickaloon of Cantwell for helping me with a story about Kantishna's Music Festival. Our theme music is by Bumua. For more on the other music we use, head to our website, akradio.org. While you're there, sign up for our podcast, browse our archives, or send us an email and tell us how we're doing. AK's Ellen Lockyer reported from Anchorage this week. Our senior producer is Jessica Cochran. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. And our editor and executive producer is Duncan Moon. I'm Scott Burton.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of AK. To listen to the broadcast version or to hear earlier shows from our archives, visit akradio.org. Send feedback about the show to ak@aprn.org. And if you like what you hear, remember to support your local public radio station.